This is a Pinball News production.
Well, while my story is going to be about games, the real story, and you should have gotten it from some of the things Pat said, is really about the people, because at Williams Electronics, we had the most amazing collection of brilliant, passionate, dedicated people that accomplished so much. And it's really rare to have that kind of a group. I haven't seen it before. I haven't seen it since. And it's all this amazing talent that made it all happen. Here we have a picture of the sauropods at work designing their games. And in beautiful harmony, all these brilliant people are working, creating the greatest pinball machines. You can almost hear the Jurassic Park music, da-da-da-da-da, as things are peaceful and productive in engineering. Those of you that have been around engineering know that it's really a little more like this. You got a lot of different personalities, strong egos, really driven people with concepts, goals, and know what they're doing, and we don't always line up, we don't always agree, and George Gomez used to call it warring gangs of the eight design teams, and on some days it sort of felt like this. The luckiest thing to happen to me in my life is the day I walked into Williams. There were two guys there that were sort of shaking things up, Eugene Jarvis and Steve Ritchie. They took me under their wing, and it was sort of, it was a really interesting time in 1980 because Williams was still an old school pinball company, and you know, there was a way that we made pinballs. And Steve and Eugene kind of had come in and shaken things up a little. Flash had come out, Firepower had come out. And just to get an understanding of how conservative the company was and parts of the company were, when they first made Hot Tip, the first solid state game, they put a score motor in the game. It did nothing, but there was a feeling, oh, if you don't hear the zzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzzz electronic sounds in the games. There was a dip switch on it for them to make chime noises. So I walked into this situation where there were there were really two factions, and Steve and Eugene had total respect for the people before him and for the people that really created this business in this game that we all loved. But there was still a tug of war going on over the future of this company. And they saw me as being a guy to quickly come in and we'll get him on our team. And it was the best thing that ever happened to me. You guys know how brilliant and amazing these guys are. And to have them as your mentors on the first day that you enter a business, it was really something. So through their eyes, they try to explain to me how this industry works, and they start to talk to me about the tar pits and all the relics and the ancient people, okay, that are kind of stuck there, with kind of the old ideas of pinball. And again, there was no lack of respect, and Steve Ritchie and Steve Kordek worked side by side, not always agreeing, but it worked out. It worked out, and it was not a matter of respect, but a matter of a different thought and a different opinion. And Steve Kordek, who was amazing, very dear friend of mine, what was incredible with Steve was decade after decade, as technology changed and ways to make games and styles and the video boom and ups and downs of pinball and everything else, he adapted to all of it. And the older we get, the harder it is to adapt. And so the group of elders was affectionately referred to as dinosaurs. And this There was a place in Chicago, which was in the vicinity at the time, Williams, Bally, Sterner, Chicago Coin were all in this near northwest corridor of Chicago. And there was a restaurant called the Round Robin Restaurant on Diversey near Western. And people who worked together or other people, it kind of became the coin machine hangout. And I couldn't find any pictures of the restaurant, but a lot of people collect matchbooks and menus. And so all the coin machine people used to go there, and Steve used to take me there for lunch, Steve Ritchie, and it was affectionately known as the Dinosaur Club. And so, you know, let's go to the club for lunch. And that's sort of kind of where this whole terminology came from. The one and only time that I met Harry Williams, he was in Chicago. Harry was still drawing play fields for Gary Stern. And I guess there's Harry and Sam over there on the wall, which is a great dinosaur picture. I don't remember a lot about the conversation we had, the one dinner I had with Steve and Harry. I do remember the sparkle in Harry's eyes, okay? He was 75, 80 years old, and he was excited about everything that he talked about, and he had such a passion for this. And he really was a little kid in a big body, and it's something that I've come to notice that, you know, most of the best designers, all these people I worked with, were all overgrown kids. And I'll go into that a little more later. A quick plug, these slides, I've dug through thousands of pictures to pull out the pinball pictures over the years, and it's inconsistent what I was able to find, so there are some areas that I've got some really great stuff on, some areas that are missing. Great company called Scan Cafe. You ship them all your pictures. They scan them. They touch them up. They really do a great job. Send you back a digital version. And thanks to Scan Cafe, we have all these pictures today for this presentation. Now, the reason I'm telling you that I love dolphins is I do want to get some questions and do some question time, because when I got all the pictures scanned, they got all of my personal pictures done too. And so at the end of this presentation, if we run out of pictures before we run out of time, okay, I'm going to show you a lot of pictures of me with dolphins. So get some questions together that are good so that we can spend some of this time answering some questions. All right, I'm again going to talk as much as I can about people and then games, but I'm going to start with a little intro about me and why I'm here and how this happened. And it started when I was in college. If you look, there's my first pinball machine. Can anyone name it besides Duncan from the yard? I don't know if you can see that much there. That's a Bally Wiggler from 1967. And when you want to have a pinball machine in your dorm room, you have to decide a pinball machine or a bed, or build a structure to put the bed up in the air so that you can have your desk under it and still have room for the pinball machine. I like to tinker a lot with a lot of things, and you can't see it all here, but there's a lot of wiring going on. There's a little box here that controlled everything in the room. The stereo was controlled. It was here. And then I had a remote control flipper box that I built for the Wiggler, and there was a number of people where I would be sitting on the bed with the flipper box that we said, hey, you know, we've developed voice recognition. And we'd have them walk up, and they'd go left, right, left, both. And I'm sitting with the box, flipping the flippers. It wouldn't be a tall order to do now, but in 1978, it was a little more difficult. Right there, I don't know if you can see. Oh, can we get the lights down, David? There's the wire for the flippers is running in a spiral down this little pole here, and then it goes under and up in the machine. So. That's kind of just a look. Oh, that's much better. Is that, and anybody wants to move up, I've got a lot of detail and a lot of pictures. If you want to get closer, you'll probably see better. And that's me at the desk under the bed, actually grinding coffee. No big deal. And then you'll notice in that first picture over in the corner, here I had a beautiful 9-inch black and white television. With the very first Atari 2600 that came out. which is not on the shelf because it's down for another picture. And when I got my 2600, my friends would all come to the room. We'd play video games quite a bit. And it looks here like Atari really nicely put all the controllers into the game and you pick up the controller that you need. But in reality, they have one set of controller jacks for left and for right, and you had to pull out your controller and put in the new controller. And so I went to Eli's Electronics, got some components, made this little box where you use this switch to pick which controller is connected in, hook up the controllers, and it worked pretty well. I was excited about it. I wrote a letter to Atari with these pictures saying, you know, here's the greatest thing, you know, why don't you make it and send me royalty checks? I got back this letter from them that basically said, sign our agreement, our submission agreement, a similar one that we use today when people submit ideas to us, which basically says, thank you for your idea, we'll do what we want with it, and maybe we'll think of you, maybe we won't. So I signed it, sent it back to them with a letter, and got this beautiful thank you, but no thank you. It turns out that I shut off my laser. Signed by Steve Bristow. He was the VP of engineering for Atari. I never looked at the letter since then until I pulled it out a month ago to show. And a very brilliant engineer who I would meet years later at Atari. And so that was pretty cool. But it was a false start on getting into the business. My picture here is kind of staged with these two drawers here and the wires tucked in there. The reality of my invention, in quotes, is as you took out the controllers and then played this game and played that game, it became one giant tangled mess. So there was a real problem there, but this wasn't a very good solution to it. But it was a problem, and the industry came up with some really great solutions. They just put more and more buttons and joysticks and dials onto the single controller, and now we're making them wireless, so there's nothing to tangle. And then, of course, there are revolutionary controllers like the Wii and the Kinect, which get rid of, you know, almost everything. So that was my senior year of college, and a couple of years later, I was looking on where should I work, and this is the most important part of my presentation, and then I'll get to all the good stuff. I was from Chicago. So I was looking at jobs at Bell Laboratories where they had prestige, better compensation, and a really interesting career path. Or I also talked to people at Williams where it was something I was passionate about. And my mom is in the audience. Stand up, Mom. So when we're talking about my passion, this was my apartment at the time, and that's my mom and dad with me, with my game room. The Wiggler has made it to Evanston with three or four other games, and there's a shuffle alley in the living room. And just, you know, Space Invaders had just come out. I played that every minute of that I wasn't playing pinball in college. And pinball and video, the whole thing, that really was my passion. And so, you know, I'm looking at, at Bell, the computer systems were just about a week or two newer than that. Or looking at this great thing I'm passionate about, and I made the brilliant decision of going to work for Bell Labs. But 4 months later, I made the brilliant decision of going, this is no fun, and having stayed in touch with the people at Williams, I took the job at Williams to make pinball machines and video games. I tell this to my kids every week that, you know, forget about career, compensation, prestige, figure out what it is you love and figure out a way to do that. And that was the best decision I ever made. So this is what business cards looked like in 1980, where there's no internet, the area code really didn't matter, and you can, you know, you don't have to print so small to put 50 things on a card. A guy named Dave Poole was at Williams, and he first interviewed me, and I didn't have his picture when I started this slideshow, so I thought Dilbert's boss was appropriate, but then he sent me one. And then Ken Fidesna was the other person. He was the head of electronic design at the time at Williams. And if you look at the story of Williams over the 20 to 30 years that are most interesting, this is probably the most important and under acknowledged guy. His name's Ken Fidesna. He, we call him the teddy bear. And his job was, if you remember my second slide with the T-Rexes and Velociraptors, his job was making peace in the swamp. You had just a lot of incredibly smart people. You had different ideas, different directions. You had this whole old and new thing going on. And he was there the whole time. He was everybody's friend. Everybody loves Ken. And he really is the reason that all of this was possible, that the different people could go from place to place. He recognized the talent of the people and figured out how to take care of the individuals to make it a place they wanted to be. So just an amazing guy. And we're going to miss half of this. Okay. This was right here the first game that I worked on as a programmer. Can anyone name the game? Scorpion. Okay, it is indeed Scorpion. And is this by any chance anybody here's favorite game? A big chuckle. I ask that because it's not a very good game. And we all have our opinions of the different games. And no matter how much you hate a particular game, you know, with the law of large numbers, that game is somebody's favorite game. And so I run across people where, you know, oh, Scorpion, I love Scorpion, and I've got a Scorpion, and I met my wife playing Scorpion, and whatever it is. It's just an interesting phenomenon. Okay, quick, can we name these people? This guy's easy. Okay, how about this guy? Yep, that's Mike Stroll. Another amazing person that in the first half of the story was the people person that gave us what we need to make it all happen. And I was very young when I started doing this, working with Steve Ritchie, and it was really interesting to hear Dave Thiel talk about working with Steve Ritchie in the same context. Things got a little exciting some of the time, and whatever the issue or conflict is, Mike had the charisma and the touch to get us to get together, get in, go through it, and yeah, we're going forward positively and we're friends. This guy. That's Paul, and Paul is in the room. Can you stand up, Paul? Paul is a very good friend of mine. He was my first boss, which was the exact role in this picture. I've worked with him on pinball machines, video games, shuffle alleys, and slot machines. Did I miss any? Paul is, in addition to being a great game guy, is the best troubleshooter I've ever met. We go along our course, we're designing electronics and designing software, working through games, whatever, and then all of a sudden you hit something. And it's just, you know, every time we put three players in, okay, the game awards a million points to the first player. Or any time I flip both flippers together, the game resets. Whatever it is, there's not a guy that could go dig in and figure out what was going on, sort out the pieces, isolate the problem, and solve it. And I've never met a better troubleshooter in my life. So that's Paul. And then this guy, hopefully you recognize a very young me. Really, really excited with my first job. So I'm...
What's that computer?
Okay, that's a great question. The computer is a Motorola Exerciser right here. A really, really horrible, horrible electronics and software system. There wasn't a lot around in that day. That's what you used. It cost about $30,000. And they used these 8-inch floppy disks. They were about this big, and they held, I think, 256K. And it's mind-boggling what's happened over the years. We use those for a number of years, and you'll see an evolution maybe if we get that far in the slideshow as we go along. So Scorpion was great for me. It was my first game, and everybody who's trying to do something and do it well needs to practice and just get the hang of something. But at the same time, I was able to do some interesting things with it. Because there were two things that was really great about Scorpion. One is there was no such thing as multi-threading in the current pinball system. So the program just kind of followed the ball around and doing what happened when the ball hit it. And we needed to evolve away from that. And we had a system that was locked down, so I couldn't change the system, but found some really clever ways with Paul's help of hooking into the system and doing a couple of little multitasking threads. And we went to use that as the foundation for the next operating system, which was developed for Black Knight. And then the other thing was Multiball had just come back in Firepower, and it was really awesome when you got Firepower into Multiball. And we started with Scorpion going, now that you're in multiball, we'll do something special. And in Scorpion, it kept track of how long you played the ball and would award 50,000 an extra ball or a special for particular time thresholds. So, again, I think it was a really bad game. I had one. I gave it away. But it was a great stepping stone for me to then team up with Steve Ritchie and work on this game. I don't have any of the Black Knight slides. I think that I organized all my pictures for a previous talk and put them somewhere clever so I could get right at them right away. And so there are some giant holes in my timeline, so I really don't have much else on Black Knight. We started to put timed features using the multi-threading capability. The two-level play field is a glimpse at something that's really been a problem for pinball development throughout and currently still persists today. When you have a couple of shots here, okay, basically this is a brick wall to a beginning pinball player, and there's a couple of little tiny avenues, one here and two over there, that let you get the ball to that upper play field. And if you get the ball to the upper play field, you can play it for a while and have two chances. You get a chance to drain the upper play field, and then you get to continue to play on the bottom. This causes a wedge between the good players and bad players, which as designers we are trying to push together so they can both have fun on the same device, and it pushes them further apart. I think that that's why the multi-level type of games, you know, never really cut on it and went very far, notwithstanding that some of them are really interesting. And I'll talk about that more later.
You had a different computer?
Nope, that is the same Motorola Exerciser with the ADM3A terminal. This is Paul's office, actually, that we took this picture in. This is in an article that appeared in a magazine called Science 81. If you Google it is on the internet. This was taken this year at Galloping Ghost Arcade, where Steve and I were together. The game doesn't look much older, but we do. And so we got this great picture of us with Black Knight. I worked with Barry Ausler on Jungle Lord right after. Anybody's favorite game, Jungle Lord? Okay, I don't like Jungle Lord either, but I was hoping that we could find one of those. There are people whose favorite game is Jungle Lord. As a matter of fact, there was somewhere in digging up these photos, there was a conversation about how cool Jungle Lord is. Anyhow, this game I actually worked with Paul on and Barry Ausler, and we, again, very unmemorable game, but there are two things that I love about Jungle Lord. One was a feature we created called Double Trouble on the drop targets, which nobody ever gets to, so nobody ever saw, and we should have not made you qualify it the way we did, and we should have used it somewhere in the last 30 years since Jungle Lord was out, because it was really neat and really fun. And unfortunately, it was on the upper play field, so you had a transportation problem. But it was designed for individual memory drop targets, and in most of my career working on games, there were no drop targets because they were so unreliable. We took them out of almost all the games to make sure we made games that would work. Okay, I'm going to just diverge for a second because, again, this is about people. This is my current team. I have a company called Leading Edge Design. We make slot machines for casinos, slot machines for the video lottery terminals in Norway, and we are just entering the social media group. Again, as amazing a group as we had at Williams, I have an amazing group here, half of which is from Williams, Bill Grupp, programmer from Williams, Scott Slomiani, did most of the Dot Matrix art, and there's Duncan Brown, who was a latecomer working on Star Wars Episode One. My brother Steven, who's in the audience, please stand up. This is my brother Steven. He has also been my business partner in many ventures over the years, and the best thing about being in business with your brother is you get to go have fun adventures all over the world all the time. And that's been wonderful. Steve Katz is our partner. Mark Molitor is not from the pinball business, but a sensational artist. This slide I had to put in because we created a multiplayer interactive game for Wheel of Fortune. It's a slot machine, and we couldn't resist with the multiple players competing, putting in the Gottlieb slogan, "It's more fun to compete." Here again, you have the whole team. I told you Mark's a really great artist. Mark, could you beam in Brian? Okay, there we go. Brian has never worn a blue shirt nor has seen this game. He's the newest member of our team, and we didn't want to leave him out. Space Shuttle. Space Shuttle is a really interesting game because video had pretty much clobbered pinball. And in the era 82, 83, it was a really dark age for pinball, and there weren't a lot of games made. They weren't very good. They were cost-reduced. And the best and brightest at Williams were moved over to do video games, so you kind of, with some exceptions, had a second string effect. Video started to wane, and pinball was coming back a little bit. And we were at a point in 1984 where we were coming back, but we weren't making enough money. Luna Castro had literally made an edict: if you can't go to the fall show in 84, get 2,000 orders, okay, that's the end. We're pulling the plug. Video was already gone. So this was what was left of Williams. And Space Shuttle was really the first big use of vacuform plastic molding. And this was enormous. And it wasn't revolutionary. There were games before it. Firepower 2 had a flat play field with a ramp up in the air. Xenon, way before that. And then there were games like Roller Coaster. It wasn't unusual to pick the ball up off the play field and do something with it and then put it back. But in the modern time, the vacuum form ramp really made it become part of the regular playbook of making pinball machines. This ramp, and I've got another picture of it. This ramp is about $8. Okay, the metal parts to put the up and the delivery, we had a shot up here, a shot around here, delivered the ball back. Probably would have been $30 or $40 worth of stamped metal parts that this replaced. And we had the Space Shuttle model. When we got done with this project, this model, the plastic part for it was free. It actually lives right in here in the same cavity. So we made the ramp and the Space Shuttle model all together. They painted the Space Shuttle model white, put stickers on it. And pretty much every game from Space Shuttle on had shots going up and off of the play field, and large use of vacuform ramps because of the cost effectiveness of this. Go ahead.
Does the Space Shuttle earn the license?
Space Shuttle is not. It was not licensed, but it was done with an understanding with NASA. Joe Kamenko actually came up with the idea of let's do the Space Shuttle game. He contacted NASA, and they said, yes, you can do a Space Shuttle game. No, you can't use our logo. So if you look at the here where it says NASA, the A's are crossed. NASA, the A's are just upside down U's in their logo. So they said you have to cross your A's and do it with our blessing. And interestingly, a few years after the game, NASA approached someone at Williams with, you know, how can you do this? You know, we didn't give you permission. And the only record of that was a letter that Joe still had. And he had been fired from Williams right after this project. But he produced the letter, and we sent it back and went on. This is the AMOA show where we showed Space Shuttle. We wanted to do a promotion, and Williams always did all their promotions with ad agencies, and the ad agency charges thousands of dollars, and in the climate of the business at the time, they weren't going to spend the money to do a big promotion. And Joe and I found a place that sold these blow-up space shuttles. We blew them up, we hung them up, probably got in trouble with the union guys. And game was a big hit at the show. They sold 7,000 games. Williams Pinball is saved. And when the show closed, people decided, I want one of those space shuttles. And they started climbing on the games and climbing on the booth. And walls started falling over with people on them fighting for these inflatable space shuttles. So it was really, really crazy. In looking for some pictures for this material, I ran across a collector, his name's Ed Chung, who has a space shuttle, but he, in his course of action, got to meet with the space shuttle crew from one of the flights, and so he got everybody to sign his plastics. Barry Ousler was the designer on Space Shuttle, and Barry, again, is another one of our tremendous guys at that company, and he never gets as much credit as he deserves. He did some big hit games like Pinbot, Bride of Pinbot, Space Shuttle, Comet, Cyclone. Really big, great games, but our business was one with a very low profit margin. It seems to me today, looking at the at Stern and at Jersey Jack, that they have changed the landscape a little bit, and they're actually, you know, making enough of a profit margin to actually have some flexibility. On a $1,500 pinball game, it sounds dumb that I say we couldn't use a $30 ramp and that an $8 ramp was really an innovation. But literally we were on such a thin margin that we had no room to put in anything more than we were putting in, and we had no ability for the factory to stop operating because the number of hours per game is a cumulative average, and the ramp up and ramp down really, really hit that hard. So we can't ramp up and ramp down at will. We needed, and again, it's different, and I think it's awesome. We needed to have the next game ready when the last game was done. And Barry was such a prolific designer that he not only would crank out a game, you know, in a week, but he was cranking out games during his downtime. And when it's like, oh God, we need a game for, you know, the third week of March, he would go and pull out a drawing here. How about, why don't we make this one? So his role, again, he's a great designer and has done landmark games, but he, if you look at in the time period, who's done the most games, I'd say 2 or 3 to 1, you'll see Barry Ousler games. Barry and his wife, Donna, are both sick and struggling right now. There's a GoFundMe that was started on the internet, and pinball players, people that worked with Barry, have been donating money, and they've raised $30,000 so far and really saved the world for these people. A bunch of pinball clubs have held tournaments, and collected money or entry fees and made donations. So if you want to or can help Donna and Barry, check out their GoFundMe, and it would be great if more people could help them out. The second best thing about making games is seeing your game on the production line. Okay, there's just something really awesome. You know, you make something, you see all the copies of it being made, you see all the steps, you see all the people employed, and a lot of energy and activity. And so every game we do, and as I go through some of these games, you're going to see production line pictures for some of the games. In between games, I'm going to try and stick in some other sets of pictures that are interesting for various reasons. I talked to you about passion and coming into this business and loving every day of it because I am so passionate about having fun and making games. My kids, of course, any given year, they're passionate about something in particular. Here it was Pokemon, Star Wars, and Ben 10. So every year the birthday comes around, what are you passionate about? We make a cake. And it's really no different for pinball people. It may be hard to recognize. This is a space shuttle playfield put onto my 30th birthday cake. And everybody recognizes that chap. Okay, Duncan, stand up. Duncan is on my team, and he's probably the second best troubleshooter I know. So Paul lives in Reno right now, and I have Duncan in the building. And it really makes my world go well. Just an incredible talent. And really, he's the Swiss Army knife of making games. Okay, we got a programmer, and we've got an artist, and we've got sound, we got math. Duncan is a programmer by trade, but he has capability in literally everything else. So when you have a small company, we have 8 people, there's a lot of everything else, and whatever the task is, it goes to Duncan, and he always comes through. So that was Duncan was a programmer on Star Wars. There's Darth Maul and Qui-Gon fighting it out. And then, of course, for Pinball 2000, we had a big celebration with a cake. And it doesn't just go to pinball. This was my company's 10th anniversary for making slot machines. And when we did this game with IGT, we celebrated there. These making games, okay, it's like having children. Okay, you nurture them, you work with them, and then you're really proud of them. So we have a lot of celebrations. You saw the champagne when we showed Banzai Run and Pat's talk, and this was a big cake where we had 100 people come celebrate the completion of this game. Okay, this is the most interesting part from finding, doing the archaeological dig on the photos. This is a great picture because there's 2 great pinball luminaries with a great game. We'll get to you, Roger, in a minute. Literally almost every game, you know, Pat showed you the Whitewood sequence of Banzai Run, and I'm going to show you a few Whitewood sequences. Most of the Whitewood sequences have a game that's really interesting and works pretty well, and then it's updated with this and tweaked with that, and you end up with something that's better. High Speed was one of the few cases where the Whitewood was a really different and bad game. And it's just really a testament to Steve and you know, getting it right and getting it perfect that we got to the game that we got to. Are there people in here that aren't familiar with High Speed? It was really big a long time ago. And this is going to be really boring. It would be time to go to the bathroom or get a drink if the game doesn't really connect with you. So here's the first Whitewood. We went to, you know, Kmart and got a Mars light to put on top of it. We're still using the Motorola Exerciser to emulate. So to actually test the code, we load it into the Exerciser, which is connected on these gray cables to the game. But we're using a gimmicks computer, 6809 SS50 bus machine to develop the code. At the same time, the rest of Williams was using a VAX 750, using a whole set of tools to work with the code and transfer the code to the games. So if we look a little closer, one thing that was unique about High Speed, Python created this backglass as a sketch, but really a fully done, you know, here's what the game's going to look like. And again, just it's kind of the whitewood of the backglass art, because it really used this look and feel, which everybody loved from the minute we saw it, but it really got improved in his next iteration. And then you can see down here, at that time, for no good reason that I can explain, there's a stack of name badges in the room we were working in, left over from some function or get-together, hello, my name is. And every day, Steve Ritchie would fill out something silly in it and stick it on someone and then maybe abuse him a little. And so one day, you know, this tag appeared on the game, you know. And it wasn't to abuse a person. It was actually, you know, looking at the expression on this guy's face. You know, he looks freaking pissed. So there again, just to compare that the original and how we went to the final backglass, just a brilliant work by Python for this game. Okay, here's the first whitewood of the game. And the central thing, instead of being a tachometer, is figure eight. And that's neither here nor there, except that the game rule that we were trying and struggling with is that your car would be one light blipping along, and the police car chasing you would be a different light blipping along, and you'd try to get further, you know, ahead of him, or, you know, not let him catch you. And we didn't have the awesome, I mean, the coolest technological leap of modern pinball right now is the multicolored LED insert. I was looking at Wizard of Oz in awe at the effects they're doing, and the lights are all changing colors and emphasizing what they want to emphasize. With multicolored inserts, it would have gone from really bad to less bad. It just didn't work out. You really couldn't watch the race and play your ball. You just wouldn't know what was going on. So that was we got this going and wrote the software for it, made it go. It was terrible. And the stoplight here is in a vertical orientation. And it wasn't the stoplight in the final high speed is an indicator of a mode of the game. This was actually a stoplight changing like a real stoplight in time. It was green, okay, yellow, red, green. And so different things would happen when you went on that ramp shot, how the stoplight was totally incomprehensible. Why is the game screaming now? Why wasn't it changing before? People didn't even see the stoplight. The white wood has drop targets. Now, this was before the modern Williams, that is Williams in the 90s. Every designer loaded up their game with drop targets in the 90s because they would then run a bill of material and say, you know, you've got to take $50 out of your game. And, you know, well, I took out $35 worth of drop targets. Let's compromise. So in the 90s, every designer would load up the game with drop targets just to take out as a bargaining mechanism with management on the actual cost of the materials for the game. Steve loves drop targets and puts drop targets in every game. Our drop targets didn't work well, and we took a lot of them out for that reason. So we've got all these drop targets here. We have two spellouts. There's high H-I-G-H and S-P on these two targets, E-E-D, kind of like Ella in Stellar Wars, for those that know the game. It kind of, what's E-E-D? Shoot for E-E-D. So that was here or there. This became a drop target bank later, you all know. As a matter of fact, it was a target bank. Three bank, three here, three there with the stoplight colors. But the real killer in this game was this shot, was the spinner shot to nowhere. It came through the spinner and went into the pop bumpers. And you can see a better angle of it here. It's going through the spinner to nowhere. And that is a flaw in itself, but the real problem we had in the game is nobody short of John Norris could shoot the ball around this loop, and at the speed it was traversing, then hit this flipper. A thing could do it also at just the right time and send it around the ramp. So the biggest modification was adding the eject hole up here. So here's the second white wood. The stoplight is now horizontal. We now have our production Mars light on instead of the Kmart Mars light. And we've changed these drop targets to regular stand-up targets. These are still drop targets. We've turned the stoplight, and we don't quite have the progression right because we've got red targets, yellow targets, and green. And for those of you that are familiar with the game, we have a green, yellow, red looking like a stoplight on each bank. Here is the spinner going to the eject hole, which now gives you a nice, soft feed that anyone can make. And with this, and we have the tachometer arrangement. So those were the big steps, and we went from a game that was really awful with a little bit of modification of the layout and some rules changes to create what y'all know as high speed. They're the green, yellow, red lights. We're now with targets instead of drops, eject hole, tachometer, and we've still got a defender pinball hand protector or lower arch because this was, you know, they hadn't made the high speed ones yet. Is defender pinball anyone's favorite game? Come on, don't be embarrassed. Okay, come on up. You get a flyer. I've been waiting. Please come take a flyer. I'm going to keep talking while you do. Defender pinball is a really interesting game, and there are a lot of people that love it. It's not my favorite game either, so just why I was checking. But literally every game is somebody's favorite game. So again, second favorite moment. Here we are in the factory making lots of high speeds. And the factory at night was a really interesting place. The games were put in on a thing called burn-in, where they would go through sequentially cycling each solenoid in the hope that running the solenoids for 20 hours would break any solder joints that weren't really tight, and we'd come in the next day and say, oh, okay, there's a problem, let's fix it. And then it went through all the speech in the game. So you have all these games talking in a Derek creepy factory that if you're a programmer, you're entering and leaving at all kinds of hours of the day and night. And it kind of looks like this, but it's very reverberating with a chorus of out of sync, you know, games trying to do the row, row, row your boat round, going fire, power, enemy destroyed, mission accomplished, you are. So I think you had to be there, but this reminded me of it. Third best thing for a game developer are trade shows. You know, they've made it in the factory, you take it to a show, and hopefully people get really excited about it. And this was high speed at the trade show. There's a younger versions of Mike Stroll, my mom, and Steven, all at the trade show where high speed was presented. Big hit, very successful game, and just a really cool story. A big part of what made Williams work in the 90s was Nova Operate. They are the German distributor. They were an exclusive distributor in Germany and a few other countries, and they bought as much as 60% of our product. Pinball was big in Germany, and in addition to buying that much product, they did a much better job of marketing it, pushing it, spending money promoting and making promotional material. In 86, I got to go over to the IMA show, which is where we are here, where you can see high speeds being shown. You can also see Comet is on the backside because unlike the manufacturer's point of view, The distributors, if there's a demand for a product, they will get them and sell them. And we were done with Comet, but they were, you know, happy to take a position ahead of time, knowing it was a great game, and then move the Comets through on their own time scale. And that's something that without them, we probably wouldn't have been able to do what we did, because our company was very economically conservative, and they did business as build to order. Okay, here's our next game. Okay, everybody tell us how many you're going to take. We're going to order that many parts. And when we get done, when we get to the point where we're 6 weeks or 5 weeks away from making all those games, you guys have to reorder. Tell us what you're going to put your money down in, give firm orders for, so that with no risk, we can go buy the parts for the next games. And Hans at Nova, on the other hand, would assess how good a game is and go, you know, High Speed is amazing. I'm gonna sell 6,000 of these. And he would order 6,000 from us. So we would build the games for Germany, take the U.S. orders, okay, ship some games, and then Hans, how many more do you want? Oh, I need another 1,000. U.S., how many more do you want? Oh, yeah, we could use some more games too. And it was getting the big orders from Nova and having the time for our customers to sell their games and then order more games that we were able to do the kinds of numbers that we did. So it was a very important part of our business. There's Hans Rosenzweig. He was the brain behind this organization. Very, very smart guy. Another little kid in a big man's body, which made him work well with all of us. He also had a seat and a voice in Williams Engineering. Okay, Nova was so influential that when they didn't like something or when they wanted something, they made it clear, and it was when Nova says jump, we really did say how high. And so it was a great partnership, a great relationship, but it's something that most people, you know, don't know much about or aren't aware of. That's Ed Valentin from Nova. He was the head of engineering, so when we worked with Nova, we worked with Ed. This is an example. We had a nice brochure for High Speed, but they had this really beautiful brochure. This is the fold opening up, and then it opens up once more so that it becomes a poster. They did the similar type of treatment for Black Knight 2000. It opened up, and then it opened up again. And again, Nova really, it was a great operation and a great company to collaborate with. In the later years, that's Udo Nickel on the right and Air Moment on the left. They, as Hans started to slow down, they sort of took over control and you know, worked with us in the same manner. Talking about their influence, Black Knight 2000 is another game that had the two-level playfield syndrome, and it is the game was a masterpiece. That's Ed Boon there, before he was Ed Boon. And Ed did the software for that game. Oh, and Ed is in the audience. Ed, could you stand up, please? Awesome. Let me tell you about Ed for a moment. I worked with Ed on Banzai Run, and we're a little out of order on the timeline here because I did this Nova segue. But Ed was in the office across the hall from me for a couple of years, including when he did Black Knight 2000, the best audio-visual presentation in a pinball machine before or after. If you agree, give Ed a hand. And there isn't a day that I saw Ed or worked with Ed that I didn't laugh my side off. We just had a great time working together, and these warped sense of humors, and it was just some of the best times. Black Knight 2000 Great game. Had this problem that the good players could do well and the bad players couldn't do anything because of the same the wall of rubber that if you're not good enough to keep shooting through, the game eats you up pretty quickly. So the games weren't performing in Germany as well as had hoped. So we were dispatched. Steve, Ed, and I went off to Germany with a state-of-the-art portable computer that's about 20 pounds with a plasma display. Battery life is zero because it only worked on a plug. And when we were returning, and I said to the German official with the machine gun that, no, we can't put that through the X-ray. You need to hand inspect it. And he said, nine. We put it through the X-ray. But we brought a full development system, and Ed spent several days in Nova's offices reprogramming rules at their whim. Make it do this. No, try that. And it became, you know, game design in Germany, where some changes were made to the game to help them. There's a really interesting phenomenon to making games, and that is, if you develop a game and you have really smart people doing everything they can to put in what should be there and what they think should be there and make it fun, and you put it on location and it doesn't succeed, okay, every person who looks at it will come up with a different philosophy of, oh, the ball time's too short, the ball time's too long, they don't get multi-ball enough, they get too much multi-ball, they don't like the art, they like the art. Everybody's going to come up with their quick way to fix the games. And at great time and great expense, the smartest people get listened to, and we go and we make revisions of games. And I've seen this done in pinball. I've seen it done in video. I've seen it done in slots. There's something that is just organic about the game that these smart people all made, that if it isn't working, that nobody's idea is going to fix it. And this is really, we went there, Ed, I don't know if you remember what you changed, but you made a whole bunch of changes. You know, the Germans were happy, and the game didn't make any more money. And it's really something, it's a hard lesson. It's a really hard lesson.
Did that change for the U.S. student, the code, or was it just for Germany?
I think it was just Germany. I don't know, Ed, if you know the answer. I just don't remember. I think it was just Germany used the new code. I know Ransom came like every third game, right? Wasn't that one of the changes? Like you press your right flipper and get a Ransom letter? I know that was one of the focal points, Ransom. But it is really amazing. And I've done it, okay, I've done it on a lot of games, which is why I've learned the lesson. And I gave this speech to a new partner I'm working with just a week ago, when they don't work, there's just something organic, and everybody can go, it's because of this, and now let's fix it and spend time and put it out, and it almost never happens. Jens Moeller, he was the tech savvy engineering guy that worked with Ed Valentin. And then a really neat thing for many years, we got our test reports from Nova. And again, when your games test at Nova, it's really important. And we get numbers from three locations, Spielotech, Vegas World, and El Dorado. Thank you. And, you know, it was like, well, Spielotech are the hardcore players, and Vegas World is the this, and El Dorado is the that. And it was really great. On our trip over there, we got to actually see these locations, see our games in the locations, and there, Pat wasn't telling the truth. There's a great picture of Ed. Between Taxi and Black Knight 2000, Taxi's also Ed's creation, another great game. Vegas World, and again, that's Ed Valentin with Steve and Ed with another Taxi. Actually, there's a Black Knight 2000 in the picture. It's just my, it's right there, but unfortunately, you can't see the right side of any of my screens. All right, I think we're going to fly through this. And anybody who was at Pat's lecture, I've got all the same pictures telling most of the same story. I do have... Wrecking Ball, again, was the prototype for Banzai Run. This is the original art done for the game by Margaret Hudson. Margaret was friendly with Pat, and Pat used up a few favors and got her to do this for us for the game. So I'm gonna fly through these because there's a couple of things that I could add. One is Pat gives me way more credit than I deserve. He said that I taught him everything he knows about pinball. This is the picture at his house, okay? And without any help or guidance or parts or anything, he builds this whole working pinball machine and tells me he didn't know anything about pinball. When I walked into the Banzai Run story, this is day one. Okay, he had built a whole lower working playfield. And if you look at it, that is Banzai Run. It didn't change much. There's a shooter that we added here and an eject hole there. And actually, this isn't day one because this is day two. I tell him to get the damn two jet bumpers out of there and add a jet bumper. You'll notice this version has three. He had built a cabinet to accommodate the vertical playfield. And boy, we didn't know anything about vertical pinball, and we still don't know as much as we should. But I do know that on an 80-degree pitch versus a 6.5-degree pitch, gravity is 8.5 times as strong. And so everything you know was wrong, and it was, and it still is. So if you're going to do vertical pinball, you know, Pat talks about how he connected the flipper. I had my games at home, and I took my space shuttle and stood up the play field to let's see what the hell a flipper can do. And the ball went about that high. Okay, and so it was, you know, yeah, these flippers can do it. The flipper was designed at the edge, okay? We made the most powerful flippers we could make in 1984. And if you made them any more powerful, they would break or burn up. So there was making a more powerful flipper in 1984 wasn't an option. We got better a few years later. But we had to live with these flippers on whatever we did. So there's the Road Kings. We did buy the Road King so we could get a whole playfield worth of parts, but the more important thing is System 11 had just come out. High Speed was the first game. Road Kings was the second or third. I wanted to program it on System 11 with all the new software, and the only way to get a System 11 electronics set, if Williams doesn't hand you one, is to buy one, and there were none for sale. So this Road Kings came with a full set of electronics, all the parts, and more important than that, and we'll come back to it, more than important of that is the cabling, okay? We can take these cables, plug them in, cut them all off the Road Kings, and then start attaching them and save 80% of the work of trying to cable a new game. So we've all seen this. This was the view of vertical pinball. You know, you'd take the flipper and you'd flip it over here, you'd pass it up there, whatever, shoot at something. Let's see how it works. We didn't hold on to that methodology very long. And quickly, we put the flippers very close together. That's actually the same play field on the game. This is the next one, and this is actually the final one. For Wrecking Ball, we put the flippers very closely and then still put a post between them. The pinball barely fits. 8.5 times the gravity, okay, doesn't matter. The ball is working its way to get through those flippers. So we added the post. This game was playable, but it wasn't any fun. You actually had to pass the ball from flipper to flipper, and then this flipper had two shots, either there or there. Both were makeable, really tough. Because, as Pat mentioned, all the good shots on a vertical pinball go in the backhand direction. And so we ended, the Wrecking Ball playfield with the art on it. John Crutch, I don't know if Pat said enough about John Crutch and I'd rather talk about people than games. This guy was working in the quality department. He had about 23 patents, mechanical engineer, going, please, please, can I do some mechanical engineering for you? And he was just biding his time till it would happen. And this project came in from outside, so it was, you know, okay, let the guy go screw up that game. Well, little did they know that what a gifted and amazing man John Crutch is. And he did all of the mechanicals in the game, including how do you take, I mean, when they assigned him, you're going to put a vertical play field here, a horizontal, and it's still going to fold down and the wires are all going to stay together. I thought that was absolutely, we're setting him up to fail. And John never failed and always exceeded my expectations. Amazing guy to work with. You're working with him again, Pat?
Yeah, he's working at one. He's doing one of the back.
Okay, John is working with Pat on his new game for Jersey Jack, so that makes my tail wag right there. Okay, so this actually wasn't on Pat's Whitewood list, so I got one here that's new. We're actually now setting it up so there's two ways to the top. You can send a backhand up through here to this flipper and maybe even catch some of these targets. This flipper can go to this ball popper, which feeds that flipper. And this is really neat, which we should have kept. This flipper shoots up a channel to this kicker, which shoots it all the way around to this flipper, which then can shoot. And I had this really warped, ridiculous vision. We're going to fill this with captive BBs, little tiny mini pinballs. And you'd hit it, and we'd make an effect, and there'd be this big explosion. It would be really fun. And mechanically, it never worked, and it wasn't really fun. But I don't give up, and we never got there. Here's the here again. You can see the BBs in the BB corral, and then Pat showed you that one. We had drop targets here, and besides not seeing drop targets, a Williams drop target, which we don't want to use anyhow because they break. They're using a spring to pull them down when you hit them, and gravity in concert. And we just got rid of most of the gravity. And so we had targets that were half down all the time. Okay, do we put bigger springs on them? You know, bigger reset coil in? They break. So drop targets didn't last long. This one is, again, we're going to have little balls going around everywhere somehow, some way or another. We're going to keep messing with it until we do. This worked worse than any of the others, but after the plunger put them into play, you're going to try and keep them alive. Didn't work so well. The rest of this is really pretty much the final bonsai layout with drop targets. And then this is the same thing. This is the final bonsai run layout with drop targets. Here we now have the freestyle area, which, as Ed always makes me laugh, the freestyle, it would launch the ball, you'd hope to hit one of these targets, and the game would go, freestyle! And then, you know, hopefully you'd hear it go, you know, redhead or yellow belly. But because we could never make these consistently be random, you never hit anything. So every time it would go, the game would go, freestyle! And then we'd go, nothing! If you have a bonsai run and you mess around with the posts and the rubber and whatever, which we could do at trade shows, you can make the ball have some randomness and it gets a little interesting. Rest of the play field, you know, I give ourselves a B. It came out pretty well. It was a vertical pinball experience. It worked pretty well. And there's you know, the final upper play field. You've already seen this picture today, but this is the best experience of making games, is seeing people having fun and getting excited. There is nothing better. You work on it, you put it out there, and they're laughing, high-fiving, getting angry, slamming the glass, and we got quite a reception. You'll notice, again, that the back glass is blue. I actually have a couple blue back glasses. Dave, can we get the lights up briefly and then go down right away? How are we doing on time? Oh, we're good. Well, we're not good. We're not going to make it to the end. I'm going to have to book this for next year. This was the back glass for test. It was done again with the blue sky, which looks really stupid on the game. And then this particular one is signed by Pat, and I will be auctioned off at the Make-A-Wish auction tomorrow night. Oh, and it will be signed by Ed Boon, the voice of Rudy, who's not paying attention. What? Ed's going to get it, too. And then we moved into this one, which is, okay, it looked too blue, let's put some trees in. And so now we had a glass that didn't fit in and look well with the game with trees. And then finally, and again, you can get a better look if you can't see it here. Thanks, Dave. There's with and without trees. And then the final one you can see was yellow, which looked really wonderful with the games. And that's why someone's going to pay a lot of money for the blue one tomorrow night. Proud Papa in the factory with his game. I think you saw that picture. And then I don't know where this came from, but I love it. Okay. Gary tells me it came from England. Jeremy Brent, yes. I've been turning my files over for material, and this fell out, so I thought I would share it. Rick Sheevy had four of them in a line at one time and actually made a Christmas card with them, so you don't see four bonsai runs together anywhere ever. And it's mostly off-screen, but Hemmacher Schlemmer put it in their catalog, and it's right there in their window. For a mere $7,500, you could take one home, which on today's standards, you know, for a new in-box game, is not as ridiculous, but we sold the game, you know, under $3,000 when it was new. So, from time to time, people have been collecting, what do people's game rooms look like? What games do you have? So I just thought I would give you a quick glimpse. This was hosting one of my children's Cub Scout functions, and if we work from back to front, there's a Revenge from Mars, Firepower, Black Knight, Space Shuttle, High Speed, Banzai Run, Funhouse, Adam's Family, Twilight Zone, and World Cup. Then there's off-screen, there's a Varcon. And then moving to the other side, we've got a Star Wars Episode One. This is Fun Ball. It's a Midway Pitching Bat, Foursquare, Wiggler, Fireball, Monday Night Football, Terminator 2, Circus, Star Trek Next Generation, Attack from Mars, and Michael Jordan, the Lethal Weapon charity game done by Data East. I've hosted the Chicago Area Pinball League twice, which in this era, players couldn't find very many places to play a lot of pinball machines with things like Modern Pinball, Galloping Ghost Arcade, Logan Hardware. There's all kinds of new opportunities springing up. And so my phone stopped ringing, but it's really fun to have the pinball gang over. And when you get a pinball machine, don't throw out the box, because there are some that think that the box is more fun than the game. Okay, all right. I have only one slide from Funhouse, but it's a great one, because in this slide is maybe the only picture of the mechanical clock that John Crutch designed for this game. As Pat pointed out, we come up with ideas, we put them in, and sometimes for reasons they don't work, but don't say goodbye because maybe they'll work somewhere else. Contrary to folklore, this is not the Twilight Zone clock. This is a clock that had stepper solenoids in them that stepped the minute hand 5 minutes at a time, the hour hand an hour at a time. And the biggest reason we didn't use it, in my recollection, is it didn't work very well, which is why by the time we got to Twilight Zone, it was done with a motorized gear system. But this is instead of the clock being on the play field that you run till midnight on Funhouse, we actually had this little mechanical stepping clock on the game next to a kind of scary Rudy skeleton. And of course, I've got factory pictures, so you get to see them, Rudy, in different states of assembly. I talked about this guy, John Crutch. amazing mechanical engineer. That's John Yausi. John, I was able to do three or four games with. He actually worked on one of our slot machines at IGT. He's done almost every game with Pat and for Pat, and again, magnificent, magnificent, talented guy that I can't say enough about. And there's Brian Eddy. Brian, this was about, he'd been working at Williams maybe 6 months when this picture was taken. He came in the door and he did all the display effects for Funhouse. One of my favorite effects in pinball is Funhouse's extra ball, which is Brian's handiwork. Everybody knows the great things Brian has done in all different media ever since. So that was at a trade show. And then at the trade show, Funhouse was not shown. Was it Whodunit was before it, Dwight? Riverboat. Riverboat was the show game, and so they showed Funhouse up in a suite in 1990. And we did have a presentation for our distributors, and Pat took up ventriloquism. He got a dummy, and he learned, you know, how to do a little ventriloquism, and he got up there and did some corny, you know, Rudy to Pat, Pat to Rudy stuff. And people have asked me, is Pat a really good ventriloquist? And to that, what I have to say is Pat is one of the most outstanding game designers I know. With Pat is Joe Dillon and Leslie Ross. Joe Dillon is Williams royalty. He was the guy managing our made-to-order business. And he did it all with relationships and working out win-win scenarios. We had an unstable system of get orders, crank out games, go to the next one, that we would get into trouble from time to time of not balancing or getting right. And this guy was unbelievable. I firmly believe part of the decay at the end of the 90s, when pinball slowed down, we went to Pinball 2000 and closed shortly thereafter. I think part of Joe not being with us at that time, he died young of brain cancer, and I think that was. But Joe, there was none like him, and he was a big part of the picture. Okay, it's time to play. Name that butt. Anybody? Absolutely. There's no doubt that looking at that butt, that's maybe the stance has something to do with it. But of course, this is our good friend Roger. Another great, great part of our amazing team. Roger contributed in so many different areas. The hat that he wore was head of licensing. This is the guy that got pinball on everyone's radar with his book, that made pinball legal in New York, lived, breathed, and ate pinball. And he was with us, you know, helping us along, playing our games. There wasn't a more avid player, and helping us with ideas. He was on our design teams. He would get the licenses, and the licensing business is really ugly because you're dealing with big businesses that have their agenda and professional talent, some of which are harder to work with than game designers. So I can't say too much about Roger. In the different pinball tournaments, both Ed and Roger were my doubles partners, and we had a lot of fun playing competitive pinball together. Roger still plays a lot. Okay, I'm going to blow through a bunch of slides really fast because being in pinball, both as a player, as a collector, and as a developer, has made it so I have met a lot of people in this country and around the world. Wherever I go, you know, it's a common denominator, and I find people to talk about or play pinball with. And I just collected a bunch of pictures of people that I really, really just cherish our friendships that we've developed as a result of the industry or the game. If you are hearing one of my pinball friends and not in the slides, I apologize. It was really hard to go through all the pictures and get as many people as I could, but I'm going to kind of blow through them kind of quickly. There's Fred Young doing his voices for my kids. We got the English group. There's Phoebe. These Schobers, I stole those off the internet, but have fun with them talking about pinball and slot machines. This was an internet chat group. Okay, we, half industry, half players, used to get together and have a window on our computers in our office, which some of us still do to this day, and we all got together at the trade show in Las Vegas. This was Walter Day and Markov at Star Worlds with big presentation. We have friends in Norway. And then, Zach's off screen, but the first family of pinball, and they really are. It's just mind-blowing to see Roger's kids grow up through the telescope of this event, because I would see them once a year, and I still remember the year at the IFPA tournament when Josh went from, the cute little Roger's kids playing pinball, isn't that cute, to, did you see the ball he just had on World Cup? So that would put it about 1994, however old he was then. And now not these kids are not only the most dominating players or among the most dominating players, they run the IFPA and the score system to really put pinball out there as it's growing in visibility, which I hear a lot of good rumblings in that arena also. So let's hear it for the first family of pinball. Again, Gary Flowers in there. He got cut off on the left side. But Gary and Jim, Gary paid us a visit, and we had a great dinner with Steve, Diana, and their wives. I'm sorry, Mark, Steve, and their wives. I'd like to spend more time, but I want to keep this thing moving. So, and now we're up to Adam's family. I don't have a lot of Adam's family pictures, and there have been whole presentations on Adam's family. This is the mold for the original cloud for the top of Adam's family. A great sculptor, his name is Jerry Pinsler. He made the molds for Rudy. He made Adam's family and a lot of the big crafted, you know, items that look like something. He makes out of clay, and then we make the molds out of them to develop the games. That was the original mold for Adam's family. Great situation. We had Adam's family nearly done when the movie opened, and Roger got us red carpet treatment to come out to L.A., be on Rick D's radio show the morning of the premiere with Hammer, who was on the radio show with us. And then the game was at the black tie reception. Actually, it was wear black was the dress code for the Adams Family theme. And Hammer's there playing the game. And Roger's over his left shoulder, on his right shoulder on the left side there. Not visible. I can see him there on my screen. And that's Jimmy Workman. He played Pugsley in the movie, you know, both playing our game. And it was an interesting time because the play field was great. The toys were great. Pat and I were arguing and going about the rules because we couldn't get the appearance of thing at the right frequency. And Roger kind of was the mediator who kind of worked us through iteration after iteration, and by the time we came back for this, we knew exactly what to do. And as I say, the rest is history. Last year, we got to come up and give the presentation on the game. Amazing group of people. I think I've hit everybody but Chris. Worked with Chris on a lot of games. Chris helped pioneer the transition from geek programmer does interesting sounds and tries to make music to schooled musician makes music. He came in about 86 and Pinbot was his first game where they put a Yamaha synthesizer in the game and did it. I've loved working with Chris and for my style of creating game effects and game rules, there's nobody better to make the sound. Missing from this picture, he didn't join us last year, is Mike Boone. Mike Boone did a lot of the software with me on Adam's Family and had a lot of great contribution. You go to Las Vegas, you're going down the strip, you look up at the sign, and there's, you know, great blackjack odds, and here's a showroom tonight and whatever, and we got to see at Silver City before they tore it down, we've got a T2 pinball. Hasta la vista, baby. So this was, I'm into a bunch of random pictures here, and that's as good as any. This was the entrance to to our facility at 341. Steve Ritchie, stand up. Stand up. Stand up, Steve. All right. Brilliant pinball developer, great friend. Brilliant pinball developer, great friend. Awesome games. Play Star Trek. Play Star Trek. This is the entrance of 3401 California. Those are back to the days of the dinosaurs. When we acquired the Bally Amusement Group, they added these matching plaques. With the some little magic, I think we can beam in the Pinball 2000 team. And there they are at the entrance. When we developed Pinball 2000, they did an article in Euroslot, and they gathered our group and took this cool picture. Again, I don't have the time to single out everybody in here, but the talent that we had was unbelievable in this project where we were given so much to do with such a high goal in so little time. Didn't commercially succeed, but the fact that it is what it is a testament to how great this whole group is. And know the code. Okay, this picture is in all your Pinball 2000 games. If you, too bad you can't see it on the screen. Left and right flipper buttons together, and then you do one right, one left, two rights, one left, three rights, and two lefts. And that will put that picture on either Revenge from Mars or Star Wars. This is the same group a little 10 years later. We did a presentation here. It's much of the same group again. One thing about the whole group of people, and I don't know if you can even get it as all my friends are here and walking in and out of the room, we all respect and we're all really good friends. And it's gone on, you know, well beyond just working together at the company. We're probably, in some cases, better friends outside than in the same room locking horns, you know, trying to further our ideas or our agendas. This is a great picture that we're missing Steve Kordek and John Trudeau on the left edge, but this is a great group of the Brain Trust. That was the Williams cafeteria. Before the famed bottom of the stairs, often the games were lined up in the cafeteria where people would play them. And you got Greg, all in very younger form, Greg Ferris, Steve Ritchie, that's me, Dennis Nordman, Pat Lawler, Ward Pemberton, Barry Ausler, Python, John Trudeau, and Steve Kordek is where my computer's not showing the picture. And likewise, this is a group of the pinball group that all came to be with Scott and Doris when they got married. It was during the Reno show, probably 95. It says 95. And we were all excited and happy to be there. And look who's got the biggest smile of the group, as always. We repeated that get-together when Lewis got married. This group is mostly programmers. Lewis is a great programmer. And the programmers probably don't get as much attention and respect as they deserve. I've managed to, but some of the guys here are every bit as good and really don't get the acknowledgement and recognition. Every game you play is the programmer's interpretation of the game. Now, whether the programmer interpreted what the game designer told him well or not, okay, you are playing the programmer's interpretation. And in every case, the game designer gave some big sweeping strokes And then the programmer made all the things happen, and it either got flow and is fun and works and you understand it, or it wasn't done well. And some of the designers create the play field, here you go, and the programmer really does all what we would call game design. So we've got Tom Uban, Lyman Sheets, who absolute master of balance and balancing out the rules in the game. There's Crutch again, Pat, Bill Grupp, he's on my team, programmed Corvette, Johnny Mnemonic, Congo. There's me, Lewis, Cameron Silver, Scared Stiff, Star Wars Episode One, a few others. Keith Johnson's at Jersey Jack. Not in that picture is Dwight Sullivan, who's in the audience. Dwight, stand up. Dwight is one of the most imaginative creative programmers out there, and he always had a lot of great ideas, and at the end of the Williams line, he started working as a game designer in addition to doing the programs. Matt Coriel isn't here. Bill Futzenreiter, another great programmer. I'm sure there are others, but they just they don't get their share of credit for the most part. And seeing this picture just made me want to sing their praises a little. After Williams closed, the pinball group would periodically, and it got less and less frequent, we would all get together for lunch. We were doing it once a month, then once a quarter, then every year or so. I think this might have been the last one we did. Steve Kordek used to live for these get-togethers. And, you know, part of, I think, what kept us driven to do it was sort of being a big celebration with him. This was the last one in 2010 when we had quite a big group, just everybody dropping their work for a day, coming out for lunch and going home. And this was a couple years later. This was at Steve's 100th birthday party. We had a bigger bash. About 75 people came in for his party. If you look carefully in the picture, you got Rob and Mike actually drove in from Ohio. There's Rob. There's Mike. We had a really wonderful celebration. The talent works with us at all different levels. I think it was on a scale of 1 to Arnold Schwarzenegger was the range of how cooperative or uncooperative, with Arnold being the worst. Not Arnold. I meant, help me, Roger. No, it wasn't Arnold. I'm mixing my stars. Stallone. Thank you. 1 to Stallone was the level of cooperation. Probably Cassandra Peterson, Elvira. Was the most, I will do anything, I'm part of this. And she worked, and it shows in their voice work in the games. Raul Julia was amazing, and it shows in his voice work in Adam's Family. Angelica Houston's right up there, okay, with Sly, in you know, she wouldn't let us use her voice, and then she made us give her successive nose jabs in the artwork before she would let us print the back glass. Okay, there's a tangential story. If I have time, I'm running out. So here is Cassandra Peterson with the Scared Stiff team. And in this picture, you know, I love this picture because I'm sure that Cassandra must be showing her new nail polish. That has to be what they're all looking at. If you've talked to us or heard about folklore, there's the famed bottom of the stairs, where when a game was developed, it's the design team works on it. Different people that aren't on the design team have different access to the games, and that varied by who you were friendly with, how high you were in the organization, and if you had permission from the team. It was generally not open for anyone in the company to come in and out and play. So the big day was when your game gets put at the bottom of the stairs, and now everybody's going to play it. We're going to find mechanical problems. We're going to find software bugs. But we're going to hear from these really smart, creative people, okay, what's wrong with your game? Okay, and here's a great picture of Hans with George with a Corvette. The process of getting all the smart people involved is supposed to be called cross-pollinization. Okay, at Williams, all right, we had a different name for that. Okay, and we called it cross-urinization because you pour your heart and soul out, you develop the best game you can, you put it at the bottom of the stairs, and everybody verbally pees on it. And so it's a great moment in the game, but it's just because of the dynamic with all the velociraptors and T-Rexes there, it was both great, useful, and scary time in a game. When I went to college, I went to classes, I did my homework. When I wasn't doing one of those things or sleeping, I was probably in the MIT Student Center pinball room. And you'll even see they used to call it a pinball room. Even though you see there's a video game over here, that came after 1980. It had about 20 pinball machines, and it was my passion. It's what I did. So to come back and visit and see two games that I worked on in that room that I spent a zillion hours in was amazing. And it happened with Space Shuttle, and it happened again with Funhouse, and it happened again, except now it's the game room, okay? It's not just the pinball room. And so they had two Addams Families with a Terminator there. Just really exciting moment for me to go back there where I sort of learned pinball and a lot of time, energy, and passion to see those games there. Pat showed you awards. There were a lot of awards for our games, for best pinball, most creative, best innovation. The different models took a lot of awards. I could do a whole presentation showing you these, but they're really boring, except for this one. Pat knows what picture's coming next, I'm sure. This was probably an Addams Family Award. That's Neil Nicastro. He was the president of the company. Ken Fidesna, Joe Dillon, Pat Larry, John. Now you've met everybody in the picture. And right after we did it, Neil turns and plants a big one on Pat. And you can see how much Pat's enjoying it. Neil was a business guy that was more business than fun, and he wasn't a little kid in a big kid's body. And so, it was part of the process, but you can, again, see. I think the reaction kind of tells it all. Twilight Zone. How many people's favorite game is Twilight Zone? Okay, we finally got one. I don't like Twilight Zone a lot either. I play it, I enjoy it. It was a really frustrating time where we couldn't get the balance between the good and bad player where we wanted it. The rubber band that would appear and disappear between those two jet bumpers to make the game time too long or too short, where we couldn't find anything that was just right, is kind of indicative of it. This is something that this is like pre-Whitewood. It's a feasibility thing. You lay out a game. You want to see if the shots work. So Pat would just take a board, put flippers on it, the targets, the mechanisms, ramps, and it wasn't for the programmer. Turn it on and see where the ball goes. And if you look at it, it is pretty close. It's pretty close. Unlike High Speed, Twilight Zone is very close to what he brought up to just shoot with the flippers. One thing to just call attention to, there's three targets and three lights back there. We'll come back to it later. Oh, we're probably not seeing the whole picture anymore. Biggest difference in production is up here, where we had a very small piano shot and four targets flanking it. Everything else is pretty much how the final game went. This we don't have the rest of the wire form over to the power field. Here's the shot to the piano. Here's the shot to the camera. And there's a comparison of the piano area here and here. This is about a ball and a half wide, and the shot here was only about a ball wide, and it was just really, really hard. So a target went, and it went from there. Then the first Whitewood, this is the first thing we programmed up. It still has the bad camera, the bad piano shot. The door looks a lot different, and there's no rubber band in the bumpers. Excuse me, but we now have a little piece of rubber here to try and deal with it. Top of the same play field. Just comparing the piano areas, how small this shot is with how big that shot is. That's really the big change as we went along. Now here's the next white wood. The door looks like the door, and I don't see magnets, so maybe those were coming. And top half. We took Twilight Zone to the trade show in Las Vegas, and we had a new feature there where we had a professional pinball player, which was Lyman Sheets. This was before he was working in the industry. We hired him as a player, and every half hour on the half hour, Lyman would play and Pat would narrate, and it couldn't have gone better. Pat would go, and now, you know, you got this feature, and you spell gum, and you spell ball, and then you hit it in there into the gumball machine, and Lyman, like, you know, I mean, amazingly, would really stay on shot with the dialogue. And so it was just really neat. We got a lot of attention. It was a really great promotion. We did that at the next four or five shows. We had Bowen do it. I'm not sure. I think Bowen did a couple. And it never, ever just had the magic. Sometimes we're always looking for it. Here's the best way to show a game to do it. And lightning, you know, we got lightning in a bottle here, and it never happened again. But Pat's pretty excited about whatever Lyman's doing. Okay. With the talented people, I found just some interesting stuff. This was before Williams acquired Bally, right after Bally acquired Sega America just to get their Laserdisc game. And it's a, basically it's with every game you bring is a reputation you earned, a reputation that would have made Adolf Hitler and Joe Stalin proud to be a capitalist. Ending with every day, we enlarge our empire, no one is safe. Today we take Sega, tomorrow it could be you. Somebody's satire circulated. I don't even know where I got it, but I thought it was interesting. And then we acquired the video game and pinball assets of Bally, and so somebody thought that it should be called Billy, a Williams company. Or there were people that weren't so happy with it, so we had posters for No Wally. Steve, I'm glad you came in time for this one. There are a lot of these. When you have a creative and talented art staff, okay, they sometimes, you know, are waiting around or bored, and there's a lot of these. This is the only one I could find. And then from the end of Twilight Zone, we're kind of moving into where things aren't going so well for us. And so in Germany, there's these AWP games that were made by a Barcrest subsidiary, and we decided to make our own game. Bill and Scott, Bill Grupp and Scott Slomiani, who are in my group. There's Pete Petrowski, Kevin, the sound guy, Linda, Armando, and who's that? Nobody knows. Okay. This is the guy that's on the away mission that we don't recognize. We know what's going to happen to him. We did our own AWP style game. It was a really good game. It made money. It cost about 40% more than the Barcrest games, and nobody was going to buy our game for 40% more than the ones that were doing really well. World Cup Soccer. I worked on this game with John Papaduke. He had a personal crisis in the middle of the game, so I kind of midway took it from where he had it to completion. This game is my first choice to recommend to anybody to put in their basement. for beginning players, it's always you're scoring goals and the guys cheering and you don't have to know much else, and people really just have a good time with this game as a first experience. I just moved a couple of years ago. I only have three machines in my basement now. Adam's Family, Funhouse, and World Cup beating out High Speed. Not because I like it more, I love High Speed more, but the people that come visit me can have a better time on World Cup. We actually took an old game Pinbot and just reused the play field. I was talking about that production line, got to get the next game to the line, and we had a hole in production where, okay, what can we do? Let's take Pinbot, turn it into Jackbot, and make a quick game. And this is just a weird picture of John Papaduke with what looks like is going to be the bell on Circus Voltaire. It says the evil bell from hell doing. Okay. I've been coming to these expos a lot of years. I got a lot of expo pictures, but I didn't fill this thing up with them. But my kids would come with me, and they would see me at the autograph session. So there's Alex practicing how to sign his name. And then somebody took and brought up Michael Shalhoub's book, where there's a picture of them with me in the book, and they both got to autograph. And you can, Ryan, this is about 2005. Ryan is 4, and look at how hard he is concentrating so he can write his name just right. And then they were with me in the group picture at the autograph session, which is really cool. Down there, I don't know what you can see. All right, Pinball 2000. There have been seminars dedicated to this. I'm not going to do a lot, and I didn't have a lot of pictures. Pinball 2000 was a lot of things. It was a clean sheet of paper, and we made the very coolest, best pinball machine we could make, fixing a lot of issues and details. And then it was built as a convertible system, where you see Greg here is putting a sticker on to turn this Revenge from Mars into a Star Wars. The convertible thing was a great idea, and we even showed at the show how you could swap a playfield in 60 seconds, which you can. It economically never would have worked from the first day, okay, till ever, based on the cost of a playfield and the residual cost of the game that you're not putting in the secondary market by doing the conversion. It never made any sense. It was really a great marketing tool. I don't think it was done as an evil marketing tool. I think that as it was created, that the people that were selling it believed it. But I don't think there was a chance anyone was ever going to convert a Pinball 2000 game. Best day of your life. You put out a game and people get really excited about it. We brought it to London in 99 to the ATE show. And rip-roaring response and success. Revenge from Mars came out, and the company had the first profitable quarter it had in 3 years. Things seemed pretty good. This was George and I on the hour in London. And George will, if you ask George about this, he'll tell you about the tennis elbow at the end of this. Because every hour he was replacing a playfield in 60 seconds while I was telling you how to replace a playfield in 60 seconds. And it was just a really neat, great culmination of the great project. As Pat showed you, this is the first quarter going into Revenge from Mars. This was the first game. There's Roger in the background watching. And just like Pat showed you the champagne, when we launch a game, we're off screen. This is Pinball 2000. Pat's off screen here with his champagne glass with Earthshaker, Twilight Zone, Jackbot, Funhouse, Banzai Run. So it's a big deal, and we really do this every time we launch a game. We were in New York. We were in Las Vegas for the fall show in 99, maybe the spring show, probably the spring show in 99, showing Revenge from Mars, and they had it in the Coney Island Arcade at New York, and the Gatlins had paid a guy to dress in a Martian costume and play the game. So that was serendipitous. And then this is the Star Wars, moving from Revenge, the Star Wars design team with their game. The final scene in the game was a green screen fight between Darth Maul and Qui-Gon, and John Papaduke was Qui-Gon. Was this Paul Barker? Kevin O'Connor was, of course, Kevin that did the artwork. I just got my 5-minute notice. So they actually acted out the final scene on a green screen, and we edited it. Live video editing was new for us, and our artists were really great at doing art and animation. It's kind of like the ventriloquist story, but it's a neat scene in the game. We went to Denver. There was a Star Wars convention, so you got all of the most fanatic Star Wars fans all coming to Denver, just like the pinball fans come to Chicago in October. And they were there, and we had a sneak preview of the game. So we got to come out there, set up the games. That's Stacy Molina. She was the licensing agent for Lucas, and she was a pinball player and loved the game. There's Darth Maul playing at the convention. Chewbacca. There's what alien is that playing the game? That's John Papaduke. And that's Jake Lloyd right there. He is the actor that played Anakin in the Star Wars Episode I movie. And there's Jake with the team. And I love this where the other factory shots up till now were all at California Avenue, the longtime home of Williams Pinball. This is the new factory in Waukegan where we had moved in the interim. This is actually the very end of the Star Wars run and the end of pinball manufacturing for the company. And a big, beautiful factory. Everybody signed the last game. There's Duncan's famous photo with the expression of Steve Kordek's face, really summing up the emotion of the day. And the last one was, in a gold cabinet, which we don't know the whereabouts of anymore. So that is it for my presentation. I would love to take some questions as long as Rob will let me talk. Gary?
Can you explain the mystery of the use of serial numbers on Williams games? As an example, I had an earthquake with a disappearing building, which I would assume was early production, but it wasn't below serial.
Yeah, I can't explain it. It's really funny when Pat gave the secret, if it has an X, then that's one of these first prototypes. And I chuckled to Paul sitting next to me. I said, yeah, that worked for about 2 years. The systems were evolving so often that not being, I'm a programming and game design expert, not being the serial number guy, I just don't know what was in place at which time. I would start with Elaine Johnson, who was in a picture that hit the cutting room floor. She was serving the Pinball 2000 cake, but we killed it. Yes?
Bill Pollock's talk mentioned that you were from Bolton, Illinois, and were friendly with the, friends of the Gottlieb.
Right.
How is it that you never worked for Gottlieb?
Okay, it's an oft-told story that I thought I would jump ahead of today, but I grew up in Oak Park, Illinois. The Gottliebs were dear family friends. They lived a block away on the other side of the same alley, and I used to play pinball in their basement when I could get invited in, which was not often enough. Before, as I was finishing college, I knew Alvin. I had gone on tours at Williams and Bally. At Bally, it was with Norm Clark. At Williams, it was with a guy named Chris Otis, who was working in design at the time I toured, but somehow was in the factory. I sent all three letters my senior year saying, I'm interested in this. You just put computers in these, and I think I can help you make a difference. And the only one that responded to the letter was Williams, and that had to come from a guy on the factory floor not throwing it out. Alvin, years later, says he never got the letter. Somebody, you know, he's important. Somebody screened the letter and didn't, you know, didn't make the connection. And I'm still waiting for Bally to call. Anybody? Is that Ted? Ted, stand up. Ted Estes. Ted worked with me on Twilight Zone. He was my software manager during all the late years when I was running engineering. Did a lot of slot stuff, and he is now back in the pinball business working at Jersey Jack. You're working with Pat, yes? Okay, Ted is on Pat's. So Pat's got the band back together. That's all great. Anyhow, thank you for this very long period of attention.
Now, the good news is Larry told me he has 4 hours worth of material. So that means he's back next year to finish the other 2 hours. Right, buddy?
Absolutely.
All right. Larry, thank you so much.